He was a giant among planetary scientists of the 20th century. He revolutionized our understanding of the role of cosmic impacts in the evolution of the solar system, including Earth. His ashes are on the moon, and he has a fascinating connection to the home of this show, Chico, California. It's the life of Gene Shoemaker, next on Blue Dot. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom.
And I'm Nolan Ford.
And Nolan, today we're going to be learning about the life of Gene Shoemaker through the reminiscences of his wife, Carolyn Shoemaker, and their longtime partner, David Levy. Gene Shoemaker died tragically in an automobile accident in the outback of Australia in the summer of 1997. And he also has some interesting connections to Chico. I met him here in 1996 when Carolyn was being honored as a distinguished alumnus of Chico State. Our first guest is David Levy, a great comet hunter in his own right. He's discovered or co-discovered 23 comets. He's the author of nearly 30 books, and he was also a very close collaborator with Gene and Carolyn Shoemaker. Tell me about what it was like working with them on Mount Palomar. Define, what were the different roles that you played?
Well, we kind of all did everything. We rotated the tasks. Gene was the one who cut the film because I wasn't really strong enough to pound the film into those circular structures. But everything else we did, and the other thing is that Carolyn did all the scanning, or almost all the scanning. And the rest of it, observing, loading the film into the telescope, guiding the telescope, the three of us did together, mostly Gene and me, because we had an awful lot of fun doing that. And the thing is, we had the feeling that if it wasn't fun, it wasn't worth doing. And so we always thought that making it fun was the most important thing. And we did that. And we made sure that lasted throughout the entire time that we were observing.
Give us a sense of what was it like, you know, when you get to Palomar. Go through an observing run for a night. How does the whole thing work from beginning to end?
We'd get to the observatory, and we would be setting up the telescope, and either Gene or I would load the film into the telescope, and then there'd be a 5-second countdown till we open the shutters. At the proper place where the telescope's supposed to be pointing, we'd open the shutters and we would be observing for about an 8-minute exposure. During the next 8 minutes, I would have time to run downstairs and get the next batch of film ready for the exposure after that, and then come back up, and we'd have about 4 minutes left just to chat. And with Gene at the telescope, we would always have something to talk about. Sometimes we talk about politics, and we're both liberal Democrats, so we always enjoy talking about politics. And sometimes we talked about more personal things, and sometimes we talked about death. And there was one time that I asked him, you know, if the time came for him to pass away, how would he want to do it? And he said, I don't want to be lying in bed for a long time. I want to fall over a cliff, have a car accident or something like that, where I'm alive 1 second and fine and dead the next. And I didn't realize that's exactly what was going to happen to him, but that's exactly what happened. And it was a very predictive moment when we actually had that conversation.
Take us back to that night of discovery of Shoemaker Levy 9. Briefly tell us what that was like.
Well, you know what they say, and this is one of the few sentences that I've been able to say in my life that has been quoted over the years. I haven't done that too much, but here is something that I wrote a couple of years after SL9, and I first said it at an interview not unlike this one. The comets are like cats. They both have tails, and they both do precisely what they want. On that night, we started, actually it was the night before the discovery, we started taking pictures on a clear night, and Gene developed the first set of films, and he stopped us. He said, there's something wrong. The films were absolutely blank. There was nothing on them at all. It turned out that that somebody had exposed the films we were using to light, rendering them useless. And we did a little test using the films to see if some of the films in the bottom of the stack could be partially used, and turned out that they could. And so we finished that night while we were preparing fresh films using these bad films. The second night, the night of discovery, we had the films out again, and we were using the fresh ones. Everything was fine, but then it started to get cloudy. And the three of us walked outside. We looked up at the sky, and I said what I usually say, you know, it's not too bad. There's a clear spot over there. And Gene laughed. He said, that's our David. He's always the optimist. And he explained to me, he said, David, every time we put a film into that telescope, it costs us $4. We cannot afford to be taking films on a night like this. We're just going to have to wait. And the fact that he used an economic argument gave me an out. I said, well, Gene, what about those old films that we used last night, those bad ones? They were partially useful. And did we throw them out yet? And Gene said, no, I haven't. I still got them. I said, well, why don't we use those? They won't cost us anything, and we can continue observing through this. And they kind of liked the idea, and they said, all right, let's do it. And the very next film we took was the first of the two discovery films of Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9.
Well, thank you, David.
Okay, thanks so much.
You're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR. And when we come back, we will talk to Carolyn Shoemaker, the wife of the late Gene Shoemaker. And we're back, and now we're going to talk to Carolyn Shoemaker, the wife of the late, great planetary scientist Gene Shoemaker. She joins us from their home in Flagstaff, Arizona. Tell us about how your first meeting with Gene came about.
My first meeting with Gene came about when he came out from Grand Junction, Colorado, to be best man at my brother's wedding. The two had been roommates at Caltech. And then Richard, they both graduated, and then Gene was in Grand Junction, Colorado, and my brother was in Aruba in the West Indies working for an oil company. But he met my best friend once when he was home, my best friend, Doreen Lingness, and so the two got acquainted, and they wrote quite a bit, and he often had me get flowers for her. And eventually, they set a wedding date. And then Richard asked Gene to come from Colorado and be his best man. And that's when I met Gene. He drove over, and one day when... at the time the wedding was approaching, why, he appeared at our back door, and I thought, my goodness, he looks a lot like Richard. And and so I met him for the first time, and he had this wonderful sense of humor, and I enjoyed getting acquainted with him.
Now, were you dating somebody else at the time?
I had been. But Richard said, Carolyn, if you will take your time to help entertain Gene when he's here, I will give you this nice tablecloth for a maroub. And I thought that was lovely, and I said yes. So I did not date anyone else at that period, just spent my time with Gene, and Gene and I would do things with Richard and Doreen.
So it all started with a tablecloth.
In a sense. Kind of strange, huh?
And when did things first turn, you know, romantic, when things started to become serious?
Oh, I think it was, things grew serious kind of gradually. After the wedding, Jane decided to stay on for a couple of days, and he was staying at her house. We did a number of things together and did a lot of talking together, and then he went back to Grand Junction and started writing to me. And at first I didn't really reply because I knew that Gene was going to go back to Princeton to work on his PhD. And I thought, he'll go back there and he'll just forget about me, and I just don't want to get too involved here. But he wrote me a special letter telling me that he really liked me and it would be nice if we could correspond a lot more. And so things gradually started to get serious then. He would write me about once a month, wonderful letters, and I used to write him about once a month, and we'd tell each other all that was going on, and also how we thought about various things as the time went by. And then it was in the spring of that year that I had this letter from him, and he said, how would you like to explore the Colorado Plateau with me? And that's where Gene did a lot of his geology. And I thought that sounded great, except that in those days, young ladies did not go off with young men without chaperones. So I told Mother about this possible invitation, and Mother was very excited. She had met Gene before I ever did. She met him down at college graduation when both Gene and Richard graduated from Caltech, and thought he was great, and she always told me how wonderful he was, I started backpedaling at that point because I didn't want Mother telling me who I should date and who I should like and all the rest. But when I told her about this invitation to explore the Colorado Plateau with Gene, and it would be a camping trip, she was very excited. She loved camping, and she always wanted to see countryside and see more of places, so she said she would go along with us, and that's the way we worked it out. And so we went over to Grand Junction after school was out, because I was teaching school at that point, and met Gene and set off on a camping trip. And after the first week, Gene asked me to marry him, and I said yes. And we had one more week together, and then my folks and I were going to take a long planned trip through a lot of the national parks in the western part of our country. And so we set off to do that. I said goodbye to Gene, but we wrote, and in August, he came out to California, and we were married 1 year later than my brother and his wife.
And what was the circumstance behind him specifically winding up in Flagstaff?
We wound up in Flagstaff because of the space program. This is kind of a roundabout answer. When the USGS office closed in Grand Junction, that had been an office connected with the atomic weapons and with the search for uranium. And that office closed, and people went either to Denver or they went to the Menlo Park office on the peninsula in California. And that was our choice. Gene had grown up in Southern California, and of course I'd grown up in Chico, and we were Californians, so that was where we went. And he continued to work there, but he was aware that there was an increasing interest in the possibility of sending a mission to the moon. And he became so interested, he realized that someday a mission was going to go to the moon. He had always wanted to be the first geologist to go to the moon. But he was afraid that the people in administration in Washington were just interested in having engineers go to the moon and sending a spacecraft, but not with any thought about what you could learn when you got there. And so he started talking to people, and eventually he was seconded to NASA from the U.S. Geological Survey, and he became part of NASA for 9 months. And during that period, we lived in the Washington, D.C. area, and he kept on talking about the importance of science in the missions, and ultimately was able to get across the idea that we should have a scientist astronaut also, maybe more than one, quite a few. And, of course, he was hoping to be that astronaut. But while we were back there, he came down with Addison's disease. That's the same thing that John Kennedy, the president at that time, had, and it's when your adrenal glands stop functioning. The adrenal glands control the function of almost everything in the body. And his stopped working, and he grew very, very weak and very sick, and obviously he could not go to the moon. But he was named chairman of the committee to select the scientist astronauts, and that was one of his big contributions there.
Take us back to the big one in 1994. Tell us about what it was like the first moment you saw Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9.
Oh, Shoemaker-Levy 9 was in a class all by itself, and of course that was unforgettable for those of us who were there. It had been a not very good observing run. It had been cloudy and rainy a lot, and we weren't seeing much, but fortunately, David Levy was with us, and David was always very enthused about any of the work. And so this one afternoon, I was looking at the last of just a few films that we had taken a few days before. David was on his computer. Gene was reading Time magazine. I was looking at films. And the young man from France who was with us was out in the car asleep. And all of a sudden, as I scanned back and forth across my films, there was this very strange-looking object. And it wasn't something that you'd automatically say, oh, that's a comet. It was strange. And it was strange because it was elongated. Comets are not like that. They might have their nucleus, but they would have a tail quite often, or they would just have the nucleus. But this was kind of a long, fuzzy thing. And so I looked at it for a bit, and then I moved the films around to see if they were related to Jupiter, and no, they didn't seem to be. It wasn't, in other words, an artifact caused by the image of Jupiter. So I turned to the others and I said, I don't know what I've got, but it looks like a squashed comet. Everyone woke up, I can tell you. And Gene came over and took a look, and he was just amazed. He didn't quite know what to make of it at first. And David took a look, and he wasn't sure. And the young man, the Frenchman, came in, and he also took a look. And we went off to then at that point, without doing much about it, we went off to make our dinner because it was getting evening time, and we always cooked our own dinners, and then we would come back to observe. And we talked about it, and I know Gene said, well, maybe it's a comet. It looks like it might be related to Jupiter. And, you know, I thought, uh-huh. He told me I'd never find anything like that.
And then, of course, the comet famously slammed into Jupiter in the summer, July of 1994, and you were caught up in the whirlwind of all that. And then a couple of years later, that's when you came to Chico. Do you remember that visit as a distinguished alumnus of Chico State?
Oh, yes, I do remember that. That was a fun visit. It was always fun to come, and it was more fun because I had accomplished something unusual.
A lot of couples find it, you know, challenging to work together, but that seems not to have been the case with you and Gene. What are some of the ways that you think you complemented each other that made it it seems like it was fun to work together?
Well, we didn't always work together that well because we built our own house here in Flagstaff, and we had different ideas about how to do some things. But when it came to the science, when it came to doing the astronomy, it was just that we were both so interested, and we were both willing to give when needed. You know, we could accept the ideas of the other and try out new things, and that's part of what made it fun. Part of it was that every month, for 9 months, we would drive over from Flagstaff to Palomar Observatory, and we would drive over at night, and it was a chance for us to visit a lot, to talk a lot, and we hadn't always had time like that over the years because he had been so busy and traveling, and I had been busy raising a family, and so by that time we had time for each other, and I think that helped.
Finally, on StoryCorps on NPR, I heard you talking about the decision to send Gene's ashes to the moon.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about how that all went down?
When I was still in the hospital in Alice Springs after Gene died, I had a call from Carolyn Porco. Carolyn Porco was at one time one of Gene's students, and she's done an enormous amount of work on space and on Saturn and various planets. And she called to tell me that Lunar Prospector was going to be going to the moon before very long. And she wondered if by any chance I would be interested in having them put a small capsule of Gene's ashes, that is, if he was going to be cremated, put his ashes on the moon along with Lunar Prospector. The idea was that Lunar Prospector would go up and would orbit the moon and do its work, and then ultimately when it ran out of fuel, it would crash into the moon, and they thought probably the South Pole. And I was interested because, of course, Gene had always wanted to go to the moon, and this way he was going to get there. So when I got back and came back with his ashes, why, Carolyn Perko came up and to Flagstaff and got a capsule of them. And she told me about the inscription that would go. Excuse me.
It's okay.
About the inscription that would go on the capsule, and sure enough, it was planned to crash into the South Pole area, and it was an inscription from Shakespeare, and very nice, and the whole thing was very special to us. So, as a family, we did go back to the Cape, and we saw Lunar Prospector take off, and of course, watched with great interest when it crashed into the moon. And I have a picture here at home, a frame picture which shows the area around the South Pole and all the craters and the crater then that was named for Gene Shoemaker.
Carolyn, I really enjoyed talking to you, as always.
Thank you, David.
And
I enjoyed talking to you, always.
Oh, good. And I'll always treasure our lunch we had in San Diego a few years ago.
Thank you.
That was very, very nice.
I like that.
Yes, that was wonderful. And you take good care of yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, and you also.
I sure, certainly will, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Gene Shoemaker has been described as the father of planetary science. Perhaps that title's a bit much for any one person, but he certainly played a central role in our modern understanding of the intersection of astronomy and geology. He was a great person and a tremendous teacher. I feel lucky to have briefly known him. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio and is co-produced by Nolan Ford. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. Until next time, I remind you that we all live on a pale blue dot. Thank you.